It's the 1st of July, 1916. A beautiful summer's day. And there are over 100,000 British troops waiting in the trenches opposite the German line that they thought was completely destroyed. After a weeks-long bombardment, surely the enemy would all be killed. The barbed wire would be destroyed, the dugouts smashed to pieces, and all you've got to do is walk across. That's what you've been trained to do, isn't it, for these last 2 years? The POWs battalions, the POWs from the factories, the football teams, the church groups, the terraced houses in streets in industrial towns like Accrington and Bradford and Barnsley. And for the last few hours, the bombardment has been increased, the final crescendo to finish off the Germans. And then up and down the front line, under the German trenches, 19 mines are blown. That'll finish them off, won't it? These men, these young men, who'd been waiting for this moment to begin the Great Push, as it was called, probably what they know it as. This was going to finish the war, wasn't it? And over the top they went. But not at 7:28, not when those mines were blown, because first of all, for a couple of moments, there was birdsong. They could hear the skylarks and the other birds chirping away. It must have been a surreal moment. The guns had stopped. And then they heard this sound. And for many of those men, it could well have been the final sound that they ever heard. Some of them had already crawled out into no man's land in the long grass to try and reduce the amount of distance in no man's land. Some of them up at Bowman Hamel had gone through a Russian sap, a shallow tunnel, and were waiting in a road, a sunken road, in the middle of no man's land that we've talked about on previous podcasts. But many of them, thousands of them, they climbed those scaling ladders and they made their way through the gaps in their own barbed wire that had been cut during the night. And they formed up in long lines and waited for their junior officers to take them forward across no man's land. So welcome to a special edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And hopefully this podcast will reach you on the anniversary, what will it be, 107 years now, of the tragic first day of the Battle of the Somme, the worst day in the history of the British Army with nearly 60,000 casualties. Now, in this podcast, we're not going to talk about the history of what happened that day. We wanted to look, as we always do, at the soldier's experience, the individual soldier that went into action that day. What did it feel like? What did he see? What are their stories? And there's so many to choose from. And I also wanted to tell the story through my own eyes of walking across the 1st of July battlefields over the last few weeks. And as I did so, I recorded my own thoughts and the sights that I saw. And I want to share those with you during this podcast as well. So let's get cracking, shall we? And I started off in a place called Ovile, which is where so many soldiers fell to their death as they made their way across 600 or 700 yards of no man's land. And they were enfiladed, shot at from the side by the Germans, whose trenches ran down the main Albert road that runs through the village of La Boisselle, as well as being shot at from the German trenches that were sitting in front of the village itself, Ovile. So this is what I saw when I was in the Ovile Cemetery just recently. So it's a beautiful spring morning and we're standing in Ovile Military Cemetery, which overlooks Mash Valley, where at 7:30 a.m. on the 1st of July 1916, 650 officers and other ranks from the Middlesex Regiment crossed the wide expanse of no man's land here. About 800 yards from right to left as we look at it. And the German trenches, as we know, ran along the road, the main road, the Albert to Bapaume Road, the Roman Road. And therefore their machine guns overlooked this valley. And then the German trenches turned left and went in front of the village, just over to our left there, in front of Ovile, So they had a clear field of fire across this field, which is now covered in wheat, I think, that's growing in the field. There would have been long grass in this field on the 1st of July 1916, because, of course, no one had cut it for 2 years, because for 2 years this was no man's land. But as those nearly 700 men from Middlesex went over the top here, they were cut down. They were cut down by those machine guns and by the artillery here in no man's land. And the next day, just one officer and 50 men answered the roll call, and many were still lying in this field, wounded. Because it was midsummer, the 1st of July, it wasn't dawn they went over. It was 7:30, some 3-4 hours after dawn. So it was broad daylight, like it is today. You know, in the middle of the summer, a beautiful day, 28 degrees it was later that day. And there was nothing in the way of those German machine gunners. They'd been underground for 7 days and seven nights, protected from the bombardment by their deep dugouts in the village of Ovillers there. Now, one of those men that went over the top that day with soldiers under his command, Lieutenant Colonel Faulkner Sandys, who'd been awarded the DSO, and he was wounded on that day. He was leading his men. They were his responsibility. And we've got a newspaper account that tells us what happened to Colonel Sandys after the 1st of July 1916. Don't forget, he's been wounded here along with so many of his men that day. And the newspaper account tells us what happened at the inquest, because he's died a few weeks later. It says, a tragic story was told at Westminster Inquest today on Lieutenant Colonel Edwin Thomas Faulkner Sandys of the Middlesex Regiment, who died in St George's Hospital as a result of a bullet wound. Okay, but it's not the bullet wound he picked up here whilst in action. It's a bullet wound that he put into himself. On September the 6th, Colonel Sandys, who'd taken a room at the Cavendish Hotel, was found in a bed with a revolver in his hand. There was a bullet wound in his head, and he was removed to hospital, where he died yesterday. People try and tell me that these commanding officers didn't care about their men. We hear this so often, don't we? We see this in documentaries, and people make glib remarks about the generals being behind the lines and the senior officers not caring about their working class lads. It's complete nonsense. And this is a prime example of that. He has committed suicide because he feels so bad about what happened to his men here. The report goes on to say that Captain Lloyd Jones of the same regiment said that Colonel Sandys was a single man aged about 40 and he resided at the Bath Club. So this is a man that's coming from the upper echelons of society. You know, he's coming from a good background. He'd been wounded 5 times. He'd received the DSO. And since he left hospital, the deceased had been greatly depressed and very much distressed about what happened on the 1st of July when his battalion suffered severely. He'd never threatened suicide, but had said that he wished he'd been killed with his men. On September the 6th, the witness received a letter from Colonel Sandys, which contained the following. And he said in that letter, I've come to London today to take my life. I've never had a moment's peace since the 1st of July. Captain R.J. Young of the same regiment said that he was in the attack on the 1st of July. The battalion suffered and the deceased was wounded. Colonel Sandys had been greatly depressed ever since. And in a letter which the witness received from him on the 6th of September, the letter said, by the time you receive this, I shall be dead. The coroner remarked that the case revealed a pathetic tragedy of a very distinguished soldier who thought less of his own wounds than he did of the loss of the men. So he couldn't cope with what happened on the 1st of July. The scenes that he must have seen in this quiet field now must have been beyond belief. And it's, what, several weeks later, it's September the 6th, when he's killed himself. So that's like the whole of July. It's over 2 months later. And he said he's never had a moment's peace. And he didn't want to live as a result of that. We've come to a grave here, Second Lieutenant William Woods from the Suffolk Regiment. And what's happened here on the 1st of July, of course, is that the attack has failed completely. It's broken down, as we know, and all those men are out there in no man's land. Less than 48 hours later, on the 3rd of July 1916, carried out another attack across the same land using the same tactics. And my great-uncle was one of those. This is in the early hours of the 3rd of July. This time they have gone at dawn in the morning. That's the only thing they've tried different. And amongst those men is William Woods here, and he was from Northampton, where I live. His father was the mayor in Northampton, and his son had joined the Suffolk. He'd been commissioned into the Suffolk Regiment, and the 3rd of July was to be his first day in action and his last day in action. The newspaper report tells us that Lieutenant Woods, the son of Councillor John Woods and Mrs. Woods from Spencer Parade in Northampton, has been missing since the 3rd of July and is now officially reported killed. Woods was a member of the Kettering staff of the Northamptonshire Union Bank. Now, that's NatWest. We call that NatWest now, and there's a memorial to him in NatWest in Kettering. He enlisted in the Northamptonshire Yeomanry at the outbreak of war. He rose to the rank of sergeant and then accepted a commission in the Suffolk Regiment. He went for a course of training at the Queen's College in Cambridge, where he acquitted himself with distinction. He was a machine gun officer. He went to France on the 17th of April, and the last letter received from him, which had taken 5 days to reach Northampton, stated that he was quite well. But what happened was he disappeared on that day, and his family put requests out for information about what had happened to him. And eventually someone came forward that was with him, and they said that he was cut down, he was shot within yards of leaving his own trenches just over there. The family probably didn't believe it at that stage. They were hoping, like so many people did, that maybe he'd lost his memory, maybe been taken prisoner by the Germans, maybe he was in a hospital somewhere, and that one day he'd come back. But eventually they found his body, and it was buried here in Auvillay Cemetery, but it's then been lost in the subsequent fighting. His grave has been lost along with this line of what they call special memorials here in Auvillay Cemetery. And there's a stone here that says, to the memory of these 35 soldiers of the British Empire killed in action in 1916, buried at the time here in Mash Valley Cemetery at Auvillay, whose graves were destroyed in later battles. So we know that William Woods is buried here somewhere, but we don't know where, and we don't know where these other 35 are. These are called special memorials. They are somewhere here under a headstone that says, known unto God. The other thing about William is that I do tours around Northampton, where we go and look at the stories of the people of Northampton, and we go to their houses where they lived, and we tell the story. And last summer, I stood outside William's house, which is a lovely row of Georgian houses in Northampton, and they've all been done up, apart from his, number 5 Spencer Parade in Northampton. It's almost derelict. And I stood with my back to it, and I was telling people the story, as I've just explained to you, what had happened to him. And it was a Sunday morning, and I noticed that people were looking up at the house and they started smiling. And I wondered what happened. So I said, what's happened? They said, as I was talking about him in front of the house that he lived, they said a light went on in the house. And then a few seconds later, when I stopped talking, the light went out. And, you know, they wondered whether it was the spirit of William saying that he's still there. But of course, practically, because the house is empty, someone owns it, it might have been that they've got a light on a timer, and it was just a coincidence that we were stood there when that light came on and came off. We'll never know, of course. We'll never know. But there were some grisly sights here. Going back to the 1st of July, 1916, there were some really terrible things that happened here. There were war crimes that happened here, because it took 2 weeks nearly to take the village of Auvillay there on the German front line. And when they did, there was a major, Henry Hunt from the Royal Engineers. He came across the battlefield. Imagine the sights he must have seen in this field after 2 weeks of fighting. Eventually, they take the ruins of Auvillay. And this is what he said. He said the dead of the British were hanging on the barbed wire just over there, and the backs of their heads were bashed in. The Germans had either murdered the wounded or mutilated the dead. He said that no man's land in front of Auvillay was the worst sight I saw in the entire war. You know, and after 2 weeks, of course, those bodies in the cemetery here, they would have been started to decompose. There would have been flies and blue bottles and rats and everything else. You can only imagine what that scene is, especially when we look at it today. A beautiful scene. Yeah, in that attack on the 3rd of July, the Buffs were here. These Kent Buffs were here with my great uncle. He was to die a month later. And as they went across that dawn attack, he said, the battalion diary says there were thousands of fallen from 2 days earlier that were still here. There was a Sidney Rogerson. He was with the 2nd Battalion of the West Yorks, and they were here on that day. And this is what he wrote. Some of us remembered that sunny last evening in June when we had assembled with such high hopes in the trenches opposite Auvillay and Le Boissel. How we jested and joked. The guns were so sure of taking the German trenches, he means. Some of us, too, remember the next night when, with every officer but one a casualty, our dead hanging thick on the German wire, we'd been withdrawn, sweating and shaking and shattered. Now, unbeknown to those British soldiers in Mash Valley, opposite them, the Germans had realised that the attack was about to begin. The barrage had lifted. And one of them said the intense bombardment was realised by all as a prelude to an infantry assault sooner or later. The men in the dugouts therefore waited ready, belts full of hand grenades around them, gripping their rifles and listening for the bombardment to lift from the front's defence zone onto their rear defences. It was of vital importance to lose not a second in taking up position in the open to meet the British infantry, which would immediately advance behind the artillery barrage. Another soldier wrote, looking towards the British trenches through the long trench periscopes held up out of the dugout entrances, they could be seen a mass of steel helmets above the parapet, showing the storm troops were ready for the assault. At 7:30 a.m. the hurricane of shells ceased as suddenly as it had begun. Our men at once clambered up the steep shafts leading from the dugouts to daylight and ran singly or in groups to the nearest shell craters. The machine guns were pulled out of the dugouts and hurriedly placed in position, their crews dragging the heavy ammunition boxes up the steps and out to the guns. A rough firing line was thus rapidly established. As soon as the men were in position, a series of extended lines of infantry were seen moving forward from the British trenches. The Germans noted that the British appeared to have complete confidence that their artillery barrage would have done the job, and said they came on at a steady pace, as if expecting to find nothing alive in our front trenches. Some appeared to be carrying Kodaks to perpetuate the memory of their triumphal march against the German defences. It's unlikely that what the German had seen was in fact cameras. It was probably pieces of equipment, barbed wire or something like that, and he was mistaken. But of course, we all now know what happened next. That recording was from a few weeks ago during a family tour. Just before we went home, we went over to Ovalle and recorded that piece. And then last week, I went on my own, whilst my guests were still in bed, to Newfoundland Park. This, of course, most people that listen to this will have no doubt visited, and it's where the Newfoundland Regiment went over the top on the 1st of July 1916 and suffered 90% casualties, as, of course, they couldn't move up. They went across in the third wave. They couldn't move up to the trenches because the communication trenches, support and reserve trenches were full of the dead and dying from the two previous waves that had gone in. And whilst I was there, I did some more recording, and this is what I experienced there. So the time is just after 7 o'clock on a fine mid-June morning, one of the longest days of the year. And I'm walking along the road towards Newfoundland Park. And I'm just approaching the park itself. And on my left, as I approach it, I can see the trees, which of course weren't there on the 1st of July 1916. And I can see the first appearance of the trenches. And the first thing that struck me this morning as I walked past what was St John's Road Trench, where the Newfoundlanders were having their breakfast on that morning of the 1st of July 1916, is absolute perfect stillness of this summer's morning. It's been a scorching couple of days over here on the Somme. It really has been the warmest days that I've encountered this year. This morning, it looks as though it's going to be a little bit cooler, but everything is absolutely still. And to be honest, it feels like the calm before the storm, which I suppose is exactly the same feelings that those men from far off Newfoundland and must have been thinking on that morning what was going to happen. And the flags in the car park are completely still. There's absolutely no wind. Obviously, I can hear the bird song, the odd crow crowing, and in the distance, I can see the Tiete Vel Memorial. And at this time of the year, as I wander along on the side of the road, it's growing those poppies that have made such brilliant photos from visitors to the Somme in recent days, and the flowers that the British Tommy would pick up and put on his tunic. And of course, because they're red, they stand out against the green. Some people try to say that the poppy resembles the blood of the First World War. Another fallacy, another myth, of
course it doesn't. It's what many of the soldiers talked about. They talked about the wildflowers, and in particular the poppies. And as I turn left to enter the park, it strikes me that there's nobody here. I think I first came to this park 20 years ago. On an April morning, there was nobody there then. But I don't think I've ever been here since, where there's been absolutely nobody here. Not even the Canadian students, of course, because most people are tucked up in bed at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning. But I thought it would be an ideal time to come down and see what the park looks like, see what it looks like on a midsummer's day, exactly the same time as it was 107 years ago. There would have been thousands of men. Where I'm standing now, waiting anxiously to go over the top. And the first thing I notice is a plaque on the wall just by the huts where the Canadian students use. It says AMDG Newfoundland War Memorial Park, Bowman Hamel. I've never noticed this before, you know, normally bringing people in. And it says, this park embraces the ground over which the Newfoundlanders fought on the 1st of July 1916 and was purchased and constructed under the direction of Lieutenant Colonel T. Nangle and an architect, R.H.K. Cossius, I think is the way it's pronounced, from funds subscribed by the government and women of Newfoundland, and was opened by Field Marshal Earl Haig, the late Commander-in-Chief of the British Expeditionary Force, on the 7th of June 1925. But what I wanted to do coming here this morning was not tell the well-told story of what happened that day, not through the history books, because you can look that up in the history books. Many of you will have been here to Newfoundland Park. But I wanted to tell the story through the eyes of one man who was here that day, one man who not only saw what happened, but experience what happened and live to tell the tale. And his name was Ginger Byrne. He was convinced by a lady called Joy Cave, herself had served in the auxiliary service during the Second World War, to write down, to record what he'd experienced. And by this time he's well into his 80s. And I'll just stop here briefly, just at the entrance to the park, because there's a famous poem written by a man called John Oxenham. And he wrote this famous poem that, again, I've not really noticed before. Tread softly here, go reverently and slow. Ye, let your soul go down upon its knees, and with bowed head and heart abased strive hard to grasp the future gain in this sore loss. For not one foot of this dank sod but drank its surfeit of the blood of gallant men, who, for their faith, their hope, for life and liberty, here made the sacrifice, here gave their lives, and gave right willingly for you and me. From this vast altar pile, the souls of men sped up to God in countless multitudes. On this grim cratered ridge, they gave their all, and giving one. The peace of heaven and immortality, our hearts go out to them in boundless gratitude. If ours, then God's, for his vast charity, all sees, all knows, all comprehends. Safe bounds. He has repaid their sacrifice, and we, God help us if we fail to pay our debt in fullest full and all unstintingly. And hopefully we are repaying that debt that those men left behind, they left us in charge of, by visiting the battlefields, by listening to this podcast and others, by reading the books, but by most of all, remembering those souls that gave up their lives for our liberty. Now, as I continue down the path, to me, the most impressive thing here on the battlefield is the caribou, the emblem of Newfoundland, proudly standing on top of a rock, facing across no man's land, facing the enemy. Then as I do so, something catches my eye at the left. On the left-hand side, running through the communication trenches, or above the communication trenches, just as those men did that day. It's a rabbit. Looked like a rabbit anyway. So what I'm going to do now is climb that windy path up to the caribou, where I get a fantastic view across the battlefield on this beautiful June morning. And I'm going to read extracts of Ginger's account of what happened here to him. A first-hand account, not retold by someone else, told by him to Joy Cave in the 1980s. And we'll see, we'll hear and listen and discover exactly what it was like to be in Newfoundland. What is now? Well, that's not a rabbit, that's a great big hare. And it's haring across no man's land, away from me. I don't know what it thinks I'm going to do to it. So we'll discover what it was like to be stuck in no man's land after the attack failed that day. So reading from his book, he says, we marched out of Louvencourt, all very smart, as it was getting dark. So this is on the night before the battle, 30th of June, 1916. And when we got a little way, the officer said, march at ease. So we sang a bit. Keep the home fires burning was the one I remember. Jerry was searching for our guns. He'd got some of our stuff going this way as well. But Jerry was feeling proper argumentative that night. So we had a really rather a dicey journey for the last part. But I don't remember anybody getting wounded. Then we got to Engelbelmer. We looked sharp getting the boxes of ammo. There were blokes grabbing at everything and carting them off. Duckboards, picks, shovels and all kinds of things. I kept up with this fella in front, the one who'd said earlier, don't lose me, and he kept saying that. Three of us marched off together. At any rate, we started off in this communication trench. It was narrow and shallow, only three or four feet deep. The further you went, the deeper it got. I got a box of ammo in each hand. I had my rifle on. It kept sliding off and I was dragging it along because I wanted to keep up with the fella in front. Then we'd have to stop, then we'd start off again, then stop again. And all the while, the trench was getting deeper and deeper till the order got passed back, no smoking. That meant we were getting near the front line. Then we stopped again. The rum jar came round again. I know I was near the end of the row because it wasn't long before we came back with the rum again. Then things went quiet for a while. That would have been, of course, the pause at 7:28. So there was 2 minutes before 0 hour, and suddenly the bombardment started up again. It was daylight by then, lovely morning it was. I heard the rattle of machine gun fire. You could always hear that above everything else. After a while, the wounded started coming down. Must have been coming up to 8 o'clock by then, I suppose, but I'm not sure because I didn't have a watch. The wounded were streaming down in fours and fives, one fellow helping another one along. There didn't seem to be any end to them. You got to thinking there couldn't be many left out there. Of course, you can't see anything from the bottom of the trench. So we moved out of the way for the wounded, and I said to the fella next to me, looks as though they've gone over. Yes, mate, he said, and someone ain't half stopped a blooming packet somewhere too. They had a scaling ladder in this bay. The officer went up first, as it became our turn to go over the top. Then the other two chaps, and then me. I didn't go over the top with any dash, as you might say. More of a humping and scrambling, really. No yelling charge or anything like that. I kept my eye on the officer just ahead. He turned to wave us fellas on, and then down he went, just as though he'd been bloody poleaxed. I just kept moving. I wasn't really thinking straight. My job was to keep with the gun team. Don't lose me, the number one had said, so I kept on. And there was blokes laying everywhere. I couldn't see nothing what happened left of me because I had my ammunition boxes on that shoulder. But where the first waves had been, to my right, there were bodies everywhere, and the troops trying to advance had to jump over them. I was running past one fellow. He had a big wound in his leg, and he shouted, best of luck to you, mate. Luck I was certainly going to need. No doubt of that, judging by what was going on. The machine gun bullets was like a hailstorm. I could see 400 yards ahead and to my right, I reckon, and there wasn't a man upright in the middle of no man's land. Yet those poor Newfoundlanders went straight on. You had to admire them, but thinking about it later, I could weep. I took a quick look round. Ahead of me were two Newfoundland blokes. One on the left side was lying well up to the German wire, and the other, about 25 yards to his right, was spread-eagled over the German wire itself. They were quite dead, there was no doubt. Then there was me, and within a yard of me there was a shell hole, a nice new shell hole. It wasn't big, but I couldn't see a better one handy. So I slung the ammunition boxes down and dived into it, which was just as well.
I must have been sticking out like a sore thumb by then. And one of those Jerry machine gun gunners decides I'm one too many still standing. Me and the bullets hit the hole pretty near together, but I won. And there I stayed all day. I lay as I fell because I daren't move. I had my legs folded under me and my blooming bayonet was on my left-hand side. I was dying to move that bayonet out of the way so I could get down a bit lower. But that Jerry, he decided nothing better to do than to play his gun across my shell hole. Well, I waited all day, and it was a long, long day, and it was hot. I was gasping, and I was very pleased I had no rum, because that makes you thirsty. But I could see backwards over no man's land towards our own lines. Some of the men fallen down were wounded. I saw some of them moving, and some turned themselves over. One man lost his head and stood up and tried to run back. He got a terrible wound in his leg. And what with the heat and everything, I'd expect he'd gone balmy. He got one leg dragging and he tried to get back. He didn't get far. He got peppered. He was dead. I lay there and watched it all. I knew there was nothing I could do about it until dark, and it was summertime. It was a long, long day. I waited and waited until it was getting dusk and I could only see about halfway across no man's land. Then it got dark enough for me to try and spread my legs out a bit because they were cramped. But eventually, he did get out of that shell hole, and he made his way back across what he thought was indeed no man's land. And it took him an age to get back, and of course, he was absolutely terrified. He said, I'd only gone 3 or 4 yards or so when I came across some blinking barbed wire. Obviously, I couldn't get through it, and even if I did, I couldn't get back, but I had to be somewhere near the Newfoundland line by this time. So I listened, but I couldn't hear anything but shells and gunfire. I couldn't hear any voices. So I shouted, it's me, where are you? Which is the way in? I put my hand round my ear and listened, but nobody answered. Then someone answered back. Hang on, go to your left, there's a big gap in the wire there. So I crawled to my left. I hadn't gone far before I came to this gap. So I finally got down into the trench. And what a bloody fine mess it was. Blown all ways with shell fire, dead laying everywhere. I was getting used to dead bodies by this time. I was only too glad to be out of no man's land and away from that flipping German machine gunner. So I made my way along as best I could and I came to a live corporal. He was a stretcher bearer. Never knew his name. He was trying to bandage a bloke who was lying at the bottom of the trench, putting a bandage at the back of his shoulder. He looked up at me and said, are you the same bloke who was shouting through the wire just now? Have you been out there all day? I told him it was me. I told him about the poor devil in the shell hole just in front. There was two of them, I told the corporal. I'm damn sure one of them was still alive. So he stood up from the fella he was bandaging and said, show us then. So off he went, back through the gap, down into that shell hole. And that was it. That was his involvement. He was a machine gunner. His job was to carry the ammunition. But the rest of his Lewis gun team had been killed. He probably didn't know that. He didn't know where they were. And all he got with him was a box of ammunition, box of ammo, which of course is no good without the gun. He made his way back and he lived to fight another day. It seems very surreal standing here today. The sheep are in no man's land, grazing on the grass, wandering around. No idea what happened here. I look down to the skeletal remains of Danger Tree and beyond that, the Wye Ravine Cemetery where Charles Taylor lies in that beautiful cemetery. And his family chose as the inscription on his grave, the words that he said to his mum, I've only once to die. They were his last words as he left to come to the battlefield, and they were the words that his mum chose as the family inscription on the base of his headstone. And it's one that I always go to and take my clients to when I come to this battlefield. A brave young man, like all of them were. Just as I listen to the bird song, the odd cockerel in the distance. I can now hear a farmer's tractor in the distance and towards Beaumont Hamel, the objective of the attack that day, going about his daily business as though nothing had happened. We often say as battlefield guides that you have to actually come to the battlefields to understand what happened, to see the lie of the land and the shell holes and where the Germans had their trenches and why they had their trenches on the high ground. Which is all very true. But the other thing that occurred to me this morning is that
it's not just what you see or hear when you come to the battlefield, it's the thoughts that you have. Because when I sit at home, I study, researching or reading, listening to other podcasts, watching documentaries, it's one thing, and it makes me think about those men. But just now, in Newfoundland Park, when I'm reading Ginger Byrne's account, it goes further than that. Somehow it gets right inside you. It's got inside me now. The thoughts are much deeper, much more real. Those feelings are much more real. You feel for those men. You feel for Ginger and his mates. You wonder, I mean, Ginger was a British man. He was with the Hampshires and he'd been assigned to the Newfoundlanders that day. But those 900 odd men from the other side of the Atlantic were far from home, a long way from home. How must that have felt? Even as I talk these words now, as I walk back, it all feels different, much different, when you're actually here on the battlefield. Much more intense feelings, much more passionate feelings. And it's something you can only feel if you come to the battlefields, if you see what they see, if you stand on the spot where they went over the top. And later on today, we'll be going to Freecorps. And I'll be taking a family there to where their relative was killed and where he's buried in the Freecorps New Cemetery, as it's called, which is situated in the old no man's land close to the German lines. And that battalion, the 10th West Yorkshires, had even more casualties than the Newfoundland regiment that day. What's it going to feel like to her? She didn't even know this soldier existed until a few days ago. But I'm going to tell her the story of her soldier, and she's going to encounter the feelings that I'm sure, well, I know I did when I first found out about my great-uncle, and I'm sure many of you have done as well. When you not only stand at the grave, but you understand what those men went through that day, and you try and place yourself in their situation, which, of course, is absolutely impossible. But by being here on the Somme, by being anywhere on the battlefields, it's the closest we're ever going to get.
Those words I've spoken were recorded on my way back from Newfoundland Park as I went back to have my breakfast at our billet. And I realised as I walked along that road that I was doing the actual reverse journey of what Ginger Byrne was doing that morning as they came up through the communication trenches up to the front line. Of course, they had breakfast just like I was going to. But of course, I would have another breakfast in the days, months, and hopefully the years to come. And so many of those young men, that was their final breakfast on that day. So the following day, I walked up onto the Redan Ridge. And once again, I recorded my thoughts, what I saw up there, and also onto the Hawthorn Ridge.
So continuing my walk around the 1st of July battlefields, I found my way up onto the Redan Ridge, just a couple of hundred yards to the north of the Sunken Road, the famous Sunken Road, where the Lancashire Fusiliers were mown down on the 1st of July 1916. And up onto this Redan Ridge, there's tremendous views from up here, back down the valley, beyond the Sunken Road, see the Hawthorn Crater, the trees of the Newfoundland Park in the distance. And I've come to one of three small cemeteries up here on the Redan Ridge. Redan Ridge Number 2 Cemetery, which is just 90 metres to the west of the old German front line. Very intimate, small cemetery with just 250 burials here, of which 100, getting on for half of them, are unidentified. And nearly all of them, I think there's only one, represent men that fell either in the 1st of July battle here or in the battle that took place here at the end of the Battle of the Somme on the 13th of November. So what I'm going to do now is just wander up and down. There's just three rows of graves here.
And it's another splendid sight. As I say, it's a very small, intimate cemetery. Wonderful views, there's cows grazing in the field behind me. There's that wonderful smell, that wonderful odour. We had a tremendous thunderstorm last night here on the Somme after several really hot, humid days, and it's cleared the air to a certain extent. It's much more fresh and much easier to walk along the battlefields this morning. So I'm just walking now along these three rows of headstones here to see what I can see. And this really does once again represent a mass grave, it looks like. I'm not sure if it is or not, but that's what it looks like. Because the first two headstones show two soldiers of the Great War, both unknown. The third one shows a man called Edward Collins, Private Edward Collins, Somerset Light Infantry, 24 years old, personal inscription, until we meet again. And below him, on the same headstone, is another unknown soldier. And then there's a Private J.H. Lester from the Lancashire Fusiliers, and say which battalion, of course, he was just 19 when he fell that day. And the personal inscription is heartbreaking. To have, to love, and then to part is the saddest story of a mother's heart. Those feelings must have been replicated up and down the country, but so many of these men here from the Lancashire Fusiliers, so many of them, when I look in the register, come from Burnley, just north of Manchester. And that particular headstone also represents a man called Lance Corporal T. Henderson from the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, who fell on the 13th of November. And the headstone has both of the battalion badges on there next to each other, two men that died in the same place, in the same battle, but at opposite ends, date-wise. I come along a little bit further, just a few more paces, more soldiers, beautiful flora. Not sure what that flower is, but it's purple. And there's two bumblebees going about their business, taking the pollen from those flowers and showing that life continues on the Somme. Nearly all of the headstones in this row show two soldiers. There's a Private T. Taylor, again, Lancashire Fusiliers. He was 36 years old, 1st of July, personal inscription. My task accomplished, the sundown splendid and serene death. Seems difficult to appreciate that. A serene death, can there be such a thing in such hell as what took place here? Apart from the odd tractor in the distance, the cows are silently going about their business. I can see some farmers in the distance working on the fields. For miles around, you must be able to see 5 to 10 miles in each direction. There's not a soul. There's nobody here. Just me and these young lads. We're here for eternity. Perpetuity. Private W.C. Hodgson, Machine Gun Corps, died on the 13th of November, again aged 19. Personal inscription, forget him. No, we never will. We loved him here. We loved him still. Again, I often say this, don't I, that we're still loving that young man because we're here today to remember him. There's no end of very personal inscriptions here, really do pull at the heartstrings. Just a few yards away from the one I've just read is a Private F. Panin, Hampshire Regiment, 1st of July 1916, aged 32. And it says, the cup was bitter, the sting severe, to part with him we loved. You wonder whether that came from their heart or whether they borrowed it from somewhere else. Maybe it was a published poem, but it rhymes. Really does mean something. The roses are out. You know, we've seen as we've wandered around the battlefields in the last few days, the Commission's gardeners have done a wonderful job. Difficult circumstances. It's been so dry as it has been back home. There's been hardly any rain until yesterday on the Somme. And they've still managed to get these roses in full bloom so early in the year. Lots of different colours I've seen. I've seen pink and yellow. And here in Redan Ridge number 2, we've got red. Some of the cemeteries we've been to haven't got any flowers at all. Like the one a couple of days ago at Freecor, there weren't any there. Don't know why. And then the back row against the wall, they've all got two soldiers. I think without exception, 100 of them, as we know, unknown. Private E. Picton, another one from the Hampshires, just 21. Cherished memories of him so dear are recalled with silent tear. Two soldiers of the Great War, two soldiers of the Great War, it says. What must have been like up here, where I'm standing, as they moved across, those men from the northwest? They would have seen the Hawthorne mine explosion as they rose from their trenches just a few yards from where I'm standing now. They've gone through no man's land to where those cows are silently grazing. And it's there those men lost their life, really at the beginning of their lives, 19, 20 years old. I can barely remember being that old. As I approach my 60th year, I realise that I've lived three times as long as some of these men. Rifleman F. Ullman, the Rifle Brigade, 1st of July 1916, another 19-year-old, a brave British hero, ever in the thoughts of his dear ones. And that's it. You know, it's taken me, 5 minutes to walk along the three lines in this cemetery. But life goes on. The farmers continue to do their work. Potatoes are being planted. Sweet corn continues to grow. Some of the fields have been left fallow and there's wild grass growing. But between all this, there's a grass path. Quite away from the road. Not many people, I suspect, come to this cemetery. Let's have a look, shall we? Let's have a look in the visitor's book. There's a pen in there. One of these visitor's books, of course, is in every cemetery. And it's had a few visitors here. I can see today's date. I think it's the 19th of June. The last visitor here was a week ago. And Andy Mullen had come from Hampshire, where so many, quite a few of the men from Hampshire are buried here. The whole of June, 3 weeks into it now, has been 4 visitors that have signed the visitor's book. There's a Philip and Louise Taylor that have signed the book. They say British citizens, but now resident in France. They've written in the book, paying our tributes to the soldiers of the Highland Light Infantry lost their lives here on the Redan Ridge. It says, my grandfather, Thomas Wilfred Taylor, was wounded here on the 13th of November 1916 while serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Highland Light Infantry, but survived the Somme and lived until 1986. He would have wished for me to do this, lest we forget. That's wonderful, that is, because it means that that man, Thomas Wilfred Taylor, died over 30 years ago, was wounded up here where I'm standing now. His descendants have visited here. I've opened the visitor's book. I'm glad they signed it, as it allows us to briefly tell the story of that young man. What must he have gone through on that winter's day? Snow was falling, the wind was blowing. He's wounded here, but managed to survive. His family have come back here all these years later. Maybe, even though he didn't die that day, maybe his spirit lives on here. Though he was wounded around him, fell many of his men, many of his mates, that either some of them are here in this cemetery or maybe in Sayre Road number 2 cemetery, the largest cemetery on the Somme, which is just over the horizon from where I'm standing now, just out of sight. Or maybe his mates are still here, maybe they're beneath the soil of Somme, the Somme battlefields. It's time to move on.
I then walked down the valley through the sunken road again and up the other side. I walked past the two Hawthorne mine craters and then into the Hawthorne Ridge number 1 cemetery. where I did exactly the same thing again and recorded what I thought and what I saw. Standing somewhere in no man's land, very close to what was the German front line.
So from where I was a few minutes ago up on the Redan Ridge, I've now come up onto the Hawthorn Ridge on the other side of the valley. I walked up the new path that takes us to the Hawthorn crater itself, the two craters, one blown on the 1st of July, one blown on the 13th of November. And I've come beyond that, and I've walked through the field roughly towards Newfoundland Park, and then in amongst the crops, the potatoes that are growing. I don't know whether you can hear, but there's the rumble of a tractor as he's spraying his crops. He's having a few problems, he's had to get out and readjust something. And this is often a very difficult cemetery to come and see, Hawthorn Ridge number one, because it really is stuck in the middle of a field in what was no man's land. And there should be a grass path that's like there was just now up at Redan Ridge between the crops, but it's often ploughed over. It's often completely impossible to get here. But today, because it's been quite dry recently, and there is a gap in between the crops, it is quite dry, and I can walk down to what is another absolutely stunning scene. When the Germans withdrew from this area in the spring of 1917, and after the November battle, and the 51st Highland Division came through here and cleared the Germans away, the battlefield was cleared of its dead. So many of those dead could not be identified, and they've been, many of them, moved to the Sayre Road No. 2 Cemetery, which at some stage we'll do a whole podcast about that cemetery, with over 7,000 burials there. But there are now over 150 First World War casualties commemorated here, and like the previous cemetery, nearly half of them are unidentified. A very, very small cemetery surrounded by a brick wall. And once again, beautiful views up here. I can see back to the village that the British soldiers called Ocean Villas, where they'll have moved up from, and where the wounded were taken back to on the 1st of July. Imagine what the scenes must have been like there. The cellars of the houses there would have been turned into advanced dressing stations and completely overrun by the dead and the dying as they tried to save as many as they could. But back to this cemetery, there's two trees here which give lovely shade. Behind me is the village of Beaumont Hamel, which was their objective on both the 1st of July 1916 and the 13th of November. And then beyond that, I can see where really, I suppose, the battle did come to an end in this part of the battlefield, where I can see Frankfurt and Munich trenches up on the next ridge beyond the village of Beaumont Hamel. Just a few yards, 100 yards away, the trees covering the two craters, and then just out of sight, I can see the trees that line the sunken road, but I can't actually see the sunken road. And then to my left, as I look back to the British lines, I can see the trees of the Newfoundland Park, and even further beyond that front line. It can be so confusing here, because you think of a front line, you think it's going to run in a straight line. Of course, it doesn't. The Germans were here in the autumn of 1914. They chose the high ground. They chose the most strategic places to dig their trenches. It doesn't run in a straight line, not at all. If you look at the map, curves around following the contours of the high ground. And that means almost as I look over my left shoulder, I can see the Ulster Tower opposite the sprawling mass of Teatvale Woods. And then just poking out on the top of that, I can just about make out the two flags, the British Union flag and the French tricolour, on top of the mighty Teatvale Memorial. That's probably, I don't know, 6-7 miles away, but I can see it clearly from here. And then beyond that, of course, is the southern part of the battlefield, which is out of sight. The sun is once again peeping through the clouds. It looks like it's going to be another scorching afternoon. Beneath one of these large trees. Some of the headstones are discoloured, but they're bound to be, aren't they? They've been here for 100 years or so now, early 1920s, when they replaced the wooden crosses with these Portland headstones. Of course, the moisture comes down off this tree. It has discoloured some of the headstones immediately beneath the branches, but that's to be expected, that's nature. You can still clearly read the details of the soldiers. There's just two rows here. There were three rows in the previous cemetery. Just two rows here. And again, a few of them just represent one soldier, but the vast majority show the details of two soldiers, either identified or simply says two soldiers of the Great War with the Christian cross and those immortal Kipling words, known unto God. There's a Bombardier H.J. Brockett Royal Horse Artillery killed here on the 1st of July 1916, aged 26. And his family must have been there because there's a wonderful photo of him standing there in uniform, proudly on parade somewhere, probably before he came out here. And he's holding his helmet in his hand and his right arm tucked under his shoulder. And he looks like a very proud young man that gave his life for his country on that day. Worst day in the history of the British Army. The tractor's now moved away. Peace has returned to this quiet corner of the Somme. And when anyone comes here, they usually head for the grave of 2nd Lieutenant Eric Heaton from the Middlesex Regiment, the 20-year-old young man. His family chose that inscription for his headstone. I came out willingly to serve my king and country. But he's so well known because of a famous photograph that shows his parents standing at the wooden cross as it was then. In 1919, and they left their own memorial here in loving memory of Lieutenant E.R. Heaton, Middlesex Regiment. And he's well known because of Paul Reed. I'm sure people listen to his podcast, The Old Front Line. Go back and listen to what Paul says in a few podcasts about Eric. I think he did one recently. He talks about tracking down Eric's sister. And she'd kept a letter that Eric had written home. Paul talks about that in his podcast. So I'm not going to steal his thunder. Look up Paul's podcast to find out what Eric said to his mum and dad just before the Battle of the Somme. It didn't take me long just to walk along from Eric's grave, looking at so many men here from the Middlesex Regiment, served alongside Eric. They're here. What about those others? When they cleared the battlefields, as we said before, there must have been so many more men that they found, couldn't identify. There's a Private E. Wright, Royal Fusiliers, aged 21, 1st of July. His family have written, "When days are dark and friends are few, dear son, how I long for you, your loving mother." And the question that I always get asked on every trip, where are all the missing? You know, it's about half of the men that fell in the Great War on the Western Front are still missing. People want to know, when they look at the memorials, when they come to these cemeteries, where are those men? Well, there aren't any answers to that, because if we knew where they were, we'd go and get them. Of course, they lie beneath these headstones that say no none. Someone showed me the other day, a French farmer the other day in Bicol, and he explained to me, he spoke really good English, and he explained to me that when he was ploughing his field near Milt, not far from Albert, he saw beneath his plough a German helmet. And when he got off his tractor to have a look a bit closer, he found it wasn't just a helmet, it was full equipment. Even the identity of this man that he'd found, and he was a German soldier, full skeleton. He took some pictures, he showed me them. There's no way I'm going to publish those photos of a dead man. They're in my head. I know what he looked like. And to be in that place, to be found a German soldier in that place, in Milt, it was well behind the British lines at the start of the Battle of the Somme in 1916. His equipment, apparently, the Cornwall War Graves Commission came along and identified that his equipment was dated 1917. So that tells us that to be in that place, to be found in that place, that soldier must have died there during the German advance, March, April 1918, or maybe he was killed in the British advance, the final 100-day offensive. The British swept through that area. I think it was towards the end of August 1918. But he was definitely a 1918 soldier. That's the only time that the Germans would have been in that area.
So for our final story in this week's podcast, we look at the story of Private Ernest Copley, who was part of the 10th Battalion of the West Yorkshire Regiment, which went over the top on the 1st of July 1916 near Freecourt. And what do we know about what happened that day? Well, the battalion diary is quite short. It says at 7:30 a.m. the battalion took part in the Grand Assault. The battalion assaulted in four lines. Two lines got through the German position but were cut off, the attack on our left having failed. Casualties were very heavy, chiefly caused by machine guns which enfiladed our left flank and were so deadly that the third and fourth lines failed to get across no man's land. There were 22 officer casualties and approximately 750 other ranks. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's that battalion that had the most casualties on that first day of the Somme. And one of the dead that day was young Ernest, and he's buried in the Freecourt New Military Cemetery, which is situated in no man's land, just in front of the German line, along with many of his comrades that died that day. And with his family, we visited his grave last week. And the night before we went to his grave, I discovered a poem that had been written about him and published in the local newspaper in Sheffield. And one of his ancestors that was there that day with us was a young lady who didn't know anything about him until a few days before, but had become very attached to him. We had a photograph of him, and there we were standing by his grave. And at that point, I handed her a copy of that poem. And she read it. She read it to her mum that had known about this soldier for all of her life, but didn't know what had happened to him until we were able to explain whilst we joined in on that telephone call. And whilst we were doing that, got that young lady to read the poem. Her name was Jenny, and she's a professional actress and singer. What better way to end this week's podcast but for Jenny herself to read that poem that was written by her ancestors to young Ernest, killed on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, along with nearly 20,000 others.
Only a private soldier, only a Briton's son, buried on the field of battle. I know your duty's done. You served your king and country. God knows you did your best. Now you sleep in Jesus, a soldier laid to rest. We only know he passed away and never said goodbye, safe in the arms of Jesus.
Certainly does send a tingle down my spine when I hear those words read by Jenny. And the poem is signed off by loving father, mother, sisters and brother. So we end this podcast this week in the usual way by playing the last post in memory of all of those soldiers that fell or lives were changed forever by the events of the first day of the Battle of the Somme.